Simon on March 20th, 1984. Mary Louise was born April 7th, 1922 in Peru, Illinois. She attended Wellesley College and received a Bachelor of Science degree in Zoology.
Bachelor of Arts, really, but that's all right. Minor matter.
All right. I think if we could just start, if you can think back when you were in college, if you had any ideas of what you might be as an, what you wanted to do as an adult, if you can imagine.
I think I had several alternatives. One, I was thinking half seriously about being a doctor, getting a medical degree. I also thought it would be interesting to be a politician. Those were the two things that were most apt to happen in my mind at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose that I wanted a family, too.
Uh-huh. Okay. And why didn't you do these things?
I'm now a politician, so I did do that.
Yeah.
I did not go on to medical school because I got married. But also, I think probably at that time, I would have had a hard time getting into medical school because my grades weren't all straight A's.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That would have been in the
40s.
Early 40s.
And I presume that women were not always welcome at medical school, and if you were allowed to enter, that you had to have very good grades.
Mm-hmm. And where did you meet your husband?
He was at Harvard getting his master's degree.
I see. So you married...
As soon as I graduated.
As soon as you graduated. Mm-hmm. I see.
That was during the war in 1943.
Uh-huh.
And we then went immediately to Washington, where he was employed at the Naval Research Laboratory as an ensign in the Navy.
Now, had he finished his...
He had finished his master's degree.
His master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And you were married, and then you moved to
Washington, D.C.
D.C.
Two of our children were born in Washington.
Oh.
It was an interesting place during the war because the city itself was overcrowded, and they had to put up a lot of new apartment buildings in a hurry, which I presume are slums now.
Mm-hmm.
When I go back, I sometimes think about going and looking, but then I'm afraid to.
So after the war, what happened?
Oh, then we went back to Harvard, and Keith got his PhD at Harvard. And during that time, there wasn't enough housing at Harvard either, and they brought barracks down from some army base in Maine and put them up in the where the tennis courts had been, Jarvis Court at Harvard. And they were one story, strung out, three apartments back to back, mustard colored, with oil space heaters in them. But we were all doing the same thing. We had a marvelous time, and there were very many very small children running around. We had a good time.
Mm-hmm. So you had two children
at that time.
I see. So you were busy taking care of work or anything.
No, I didn't do anything except take care of children. I shouldn't say I didn't do anything.
Right. Okay. And from after he got his PhD.
Then we went, the first job was at Wayne University in Detroit. They offered us the highest salary. I think he was offered $4,000 a year. The other offers were all lower than that. So we went to Wayne University.
Mm-hmm.
And then our next two children were born while we were there. We lived outside Detroit.
And you were there, how many years were you there?
We were there from the end of the war from when he got his PhD, which was 49, maybe,
mm-hmm.
until 55.
Oh.
48, sometime in there.
I see. Okay.
Don't remember the exact times.
And how did you happen to come to Madison? How did he happen to?
At that time, the Midwestern universities were in the process of designing a particle accelerator. They were called MURA, Midwestern Universities mm-hmm. Research Association. And during the summers, he did some work for that organization. We did some work, lived in Ann Arbor, for instance, for one summer. And then he came here to the University of Wisconsin, where there was a group working on that accelerator design. And then the University of Wisconsin offered him a position here in the physics department. And I guess he was offered a job first at the Midwest Universities Research Association, MURA lab. I can't remember exactly which mm-hmm. came first. At any rate, then he became a professor here at the physics department. But they did, there were a number of years during that time when they were busy designing that laboratory, that accelerator, and it was, they bought property down south of Madison near Stoughton,
mm-hmm.
which is now called the Physical Sciences Laboratory. And interestingly enough, he's on leave from the physics department this semester to be acting director down at the radiation center there, because they're in the process of finding a new director. Oh. So he's back down at the physical sciences lab this
after
semester.
Many years.
Yes.
How did you feel about coming, leaving Wayne and coming here to Madison?
Well, we lived outside on a lake northwest of Detroit, and it was a marvelous place for the children, and it was a very beautiful lake, and we didn't want to give that up. But on the other hand, coming back to Wisconsin and to Madison was also very desirable. My father had graduated here in mechanical engineering and had enjoyed that so much that I grew up thinking that the University of Wisconsin was a very special place.
Mm.
And we spent a lot of vacations when I was growing up in Wisconsin, so I felt as if I were coming home.
Mm. Now, is Peru very...
It's straight south here, of here, about 135 miles on the Illinois River.
So you came, you were acquainted with Madison and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and always thought of it
feeling.
As a marvelous place, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I was very pleased.
Did you move into this house?
Yes.
Okay.
we came at the beginning of the spring semester, it was the end of January, the beginning of February, and we had one day to find a house, and it was there was a blizzard that day, and as we drove around, there was a woman who has since left Madison who was a realtor, and then it seemed like a sort of unusual occupation for a woman. And she was quite outspoken. I can't remember her name. Lucy somebody or other. Anyway, she drove us by this house, the first house, which was for sale. And I said, don't bother stopping there. It's so ugly I couldn't stand to live in it. And by the end of the day, we had purchased it.
You had changed your mind after seeing others.
Yes, that's right.
And there probably weren't a lot of houses either.
No, there weren't, and it was near the park, mm-hmm. and which seemed good, and it was near Randall School, which was very desirable.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people in the physics department lived across the alley from us, Bob and Jean Sachs, so it worked out very well.
Mm-hmm.
We've been happy ever since.
Mm-hmm. How did you meet people when you first came here?
Well, the Mura people came from various universities around the Midwest, and we made a lot of friends through the Mura group, but also the physics department at that time was small enough so that the social life, it was possible to have everybody in the physics department to an evening party without straining one's walls.
Mm-hmm.
So that most of our social life at that time was involved with the Mura people or the physics department people. And we joined the Congregational Church, so we also met people through the
mm-hmm.
Congregational Church.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting then because Mura was struggling to get the nod for being the site for this big accelerator. The National Science Foundation was making a decision about where the big accelerator would be built. And there were several sites that were under consideration, one of them here, and one of them in northern Illinois, where it is now.
Oh, is that it? Isn't it there
yes,
now?
It got built in Illinois.
Oh.
But it was the process of trying to persuade the government that they should build it here was very interesting. They did a tremendous amount of demographic and climatological research and bedrock and political climate, and I remember each of the sites was wooing the government, and they put out glossy material, promotional material. But it was finally decided on a largely political basis who had the most influence at that point in Congress, and it did go outside Chicago and Northern Illinois.
Mm.
Batavia.
That sounds familiar.
Yes. But they did. They used the property that that Murray had purchased. The university now owns it, and they have the physical sciences lab out there. I remember one of the funny things that was being used as an argument was that this area did not have as much snowfall as the Chicago area, therefore it would be easier for people to get in and out to the laboratory. Just an odd, funny fact that sticks in one's mind.
Yeah. Who was the chairman of the department when you first came?
I think Ragnar Rolofsson was, as I remember. It rotates in the department, so it's a little hard to remember. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it was Rolofsson.
They made a special effort for you to meet the other members of the department, and
yes, they were everybody was very friendly, and there were parties, a lot of evening parties,
mm-hmm.
and some small dinner parties.
Mm-hmm.
It was very pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you entertain very much?
Yes, we did a lot of entertaining. Both visitors to Mura and Mura people and physics department. There was a good deal of exchange with foreign countries and foreign visitors, so that we sort of took turns entertaining, but there was so much that it seems to me we were entertaining a great deal all the time.
You also have to house them?
Sometimes we did. I still have a cigarette burn in the living room rug where a visiting Russian dropped his cigarette. That rug is very old.
Now you came during the McCarthy era.
No, it was after. It was a little after.
Just a little after.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
As I remember, when was it? What I can't remember what
the
dates were.
1950.
Well, if we were here during the McCarthy era, I was not paying any attention, and that seems sort of unlikely.
I don't remember when he died.
Well, he was alive while we were here. I do know that, because I remember when he died, but the worst of it.
But you don't have any recollections
no.
of anything occurring? Or
I remember watching the hearings on television.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember whether that was here or in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Okay.
There was also a good deal of discussion always about security measures, the governmental security measures, and whether they were necessary or not. And mostly people felt they were not necessary because, well, most of the physicists felt that any design that was going on here was could easily be devised by any physicist anywhere.
Oh, I see.
So that the security measures that they were put through were considered to be superfluous, stupid.
So they were screened by the FBI and.
Well, for travel abroad, there was a good deal of travel abroad at that time too. Exchange people from here went to other countries,
mm-hmm.
Russia and Europe, and there was a good deal of security screening that was going on then. I haven't thought about that for a long time.
That's right. That was the time when we were very concerned with
mm-hmm.
security. The Russians.
The other connection with all of that was Los Alamos Laboratory, and quite a few of the people here came from the Los Alamos Laboratory to the University of Wisconsin, so that there was a good deal going back and forth there.
Mm-hmm.
Between these and those two places, and of course there was still security screening being done down there too.
Mm-hmm. Did you understand your husband's work pretty much, or?
No, I had never had any physics. Well, I had a physics course in high school, but a high school physics course has almost no relationship to theoretical physics.
Did you help him in any way of typing or editing or?
He wrote, he turned his dissertation into a textbook, and I typed the first draft of that textbook in mechanics. And that textbook is still being used and translated. We still get royalties from it. It's being used all over the world now. So I did that typing, but my typing was very slow and primitive. It took a long time. But I joined the League of Women Voters almost immediately when I came to Madison. And that year, one of the study topics was pro and con, the Frank Lloyd Wright Monona Terrace Project.
Oh.
And that, of course, went on for
forever.
20 years.
So the League was involved in that?
They
University
did
League?
No, not the University
the
League, League,
the League
of Women
the League
Voters.
The League of Women Voters, okay.
But I did. I was active in the University League also in the newcomers group.
Mm-hmm.
I still see some of the persons that I met in that. Some of them are still my very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was in a book group and in a bridge group, as I remember.
Which they still have,
do they?
Yeah.
But I gradually got so involved in the community that I became less and less active.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the parties and the teas that there used to be up at the president's house up in University Heights. Mrs. Fred was the person who was involved then.
Mm-hmm. He was president at that time,
mm-hmm.
in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't come here until the mid-60s, so I'm...
Well, she was a remarkable woman. For one reason, that made an impression on me. She remembered people's names so well. It was just astonishing how well she did. And that house is so much fun to be in. It was a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. I bet it was.
Yeah. Does the University League still have teas up there?
They have teas at Brittingham.
Brittingham, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
that's a nice house, too.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Of course, the PTA, we got active in the PTA at Randall School, too. Met a lot of people that way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the early memories of the Randall School PTA meeting was a report that was being given on a study that had been done on handwriting. Somebody had given the PTA a grant to study children's handwriting to find out if they wrote faster, would they write clearer?
If they wrote faster,
it seemed ridiculous. It was ridiculous. Of course, they discovered if the child wrote faster, it was less clear.
Right. And anyone
sounds
should
like
know
one of,
that.
One of Proxmire's golden fleeces.
How did your husband feel about entertaining the social life that was?
I think he enjoyed entertaining, but he's a person who was very quiet and reserved. But he always seemed to have a good time, nevertheless.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy entertaining very much. Now that I'm terribly busy, I don't enjoy it as much because I don't have the time and the energy to do it, so we don't do as much anymore. But then I was not working, and had time to get ready for parties.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was an interesting group too, particularly the people that came to Mura and that were at Mura from various universities. They were a lot of the people that we tended to become good friends with enjoyed being outdoors and doing things outdoors.
Oh.
So we did a lot of canoe tripping and picnicking and skiing and so forth. With people from.
So that group was a good source of friends for you.
Very good. We still see some of those people, even though they're scattered around the country now.
And this is people from
Midwestern universities. But there were people also from other countries that came.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of entertaining of foreign persons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we foreign people tend to bring gifts when they come to here, and so we have collections of various souvenirs. We also then went to live in Geneva, Switzerland for a year. The European countries had gotten together and were designing and building in a particle accelerator outside Geneva, Central European Research Group. And Keith was there for a year.
When was that?
It was 62, 63.
Mm-hmm.
The children all went to school over there.
Oh. When were your children born? You had two in the
two
early
in
40s?
Washington, and 44 and 45, and two outside, when we were at Wayne, 50 and
53. Uh-huh. So they're grown and...
Yeah, they're all still around.
And
they're all still around.
Oh, that's nice.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that the League of Women Voters was doing at that time was a study of urban development and problems connected with development around cities. And Ivan Nestingen was mayor then, and he had a...
Who was mayor?
Ivan Nestingen.
I see, okay.
And he had a regular television program, sort of a mayor's report kind of program. And I had been involved in part of the League study on urban development and providing services in an urban area. And so I appeared on television several times with Ivan Nesting on that subject. But that's another subject that sort of goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
How do you control development around a city so that it's desirable? And do you annex the areas around the city? And who provides the services? At what level do you provide the services for areas outside the incorporated areas? And there aren't any easy answers to it even now.
No, I mean, still those questions are still going on.
That's right.
Did your husband have a fairly regular schedule of work, or did he have sort of odd hours?
No, his work was fairly regular. Then.
So he sort of worked at 9 to 5 or 8 to 4?
Yes, as I remember, it was regular hours.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, except that it was longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
He,
mm-hmm.
as I remember, would get to work about 8 or 8:30 and get home about 6.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes work in the evening? Or
yes, sometimes go back in the evening.
Mm-hmm. But did he work at home at all? Or?
I can't remember that. I don't remember whether he worked at home. I think he probably did work at home.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did he take part in doing, you know, things like chores around the house? And
not very much, no. That was before Great Expectations on the part of housewives.
So did he mow the lawn? Or
no, I did that. He would do things around the house if I asked him, but it was left mostly to myself to do.
Like taking the garbage out, trash out, and...
Right, or the children did it.
Oh, the children did
uh-huh.
it.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
He was always willing if I asked.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I enjoyed doing the outdoor work, the yard work I did myself.
Mm. Is this lot next door to you? Is that
we each own half of it.
I see.
So it gave us some little extra room because these lots are quite narrow.
Mm-hmm. They are. Yeah.
This was a very good neighborhood for the children to grow up in too, because of the park and because of Randall School, and there were quite a few faculty people that lived here.
Mm-hmm. Is that still the case, or are there a lot of faculty living around here now, or
some? Not as much. I think it's changed.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily so. The Elders are on the corner, and the Hunter's next to us, and Andriano's across the street, and Edelman's on. I guess it's still faculty.
Yeah.
Edelman's on the corner, and the Herbst over there, and the Haygoods. It's still
mm-hmm.
a lot of faculty.
Mm-hmm.
There are young, new families buying the old big houses now and moving in, so that there are quite a few young children in the neighborhood again.
Mm-hmm.
It makes one feel ancient. to realize it's turned over again.
Do you remember feeling any great resentments, or that your husband sort of let you take care of all the
household? No, I didn't feel any resentment. I was not sensitized. No, I think I had expected to have a family and do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't remember feeling resentment. My own father was very helpful and did a lot of things around the house and took care of us a lot and did a lot of things with us.
But you didn't expect?
No, I didn't.
Did he ever help with the dishes, or?
He does now.
He does now.
Oh yes, we take turns with the dishes now. Mm. Everybody does. Uh-huh. Everybody that takes their turn at doing dishes. But again, it was a matter of his doing it if I asked, but mm-hmm. not doing it as a regular mm-hmm. expected.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Did he help with the children?
He always took care of them if I was going out.
Mm-hmm.
I presume he did some, yes. One of the things that he liked to do was do woodwork and handwork with wood, build things.
Oh.
He finished a second floor bedroom in the house that we, our first house that we bought. And he did a lot of work on the third floor in this house. We built up two bedrooms and a bath up there, and he did a lot of that work and did the tile work. He enjoyed doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Still does enjoy doing that. We're building a house out in the country now that he's built, doing.
Oh, he's mm-hmm. building it himself.
And our son.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Did he ever bring many students home for evening meetings, or?
Not so much evening meetings or study kind of work, but we entertain students a lot. Everybody in the physics department was encouraged to entertain students, and particularly graduate students. And we had we were active in the Madison Friends of International Students then, while the children were growing up, and had foreign students here a lot and took them on picnics and various expeditions. And then we began having foreign students living with us when they couldn't find a place to live when they came, students here. So we had several from Africa, one from India. We had, there are quite a few bedrooms in this house. Wally Farbach, who had six brothers and sisters, grew up in this house. So it goes up, so there is plenty of room.
Mm-hmm.
So having foreign students worked out very well.
And did you feed them too?
Mm-hmm.
Or
no, regular members of the household.
Brought them into the family. And I'm going to stop this now and just switch. This is tape one, side two, an interview with Mary Louise Simon. Okay.
We were talking about foreign students. One, I remember we were had two African students for dinner, and it happened to be Halloween night. They had expressed a desire to see how Halloween worked, and they were sitting here eating dinner. And Louise Marston from the State Journal had asked permission to come in and take pictures and do an article. And they had their native clothing on. And she came into the dining room and she said, "Oh, I hear you're all dressed up. See, I see you're all dressed up for Halloween." Oh, it was awful. Just awful. Do you know Louise Marston?
No, I know the name, but
she was their society editor.
Now they don't have one, do they?
I don't think so. If they do, I'm unaware of it.
Yeah.
Oh, I can still see exactly where everybody was sitting and the expressions on their faces. Oh, my.
Funny how things like that you never forget.
Yes.
Did you and your husband talk much about what was happening in the department or in the university? Or did he... discussing.
No, if I asked him questions, he would respond and tell me. But he didn't talk about his work very much, and he has never been a person that did any gossiping, a personal kind of gossiping about people.
Mm-hmm. But any problems with the department or...
Well, I guess he told some, yeah, some. He, as I say, is somewhat reserved, so that it mm-hmm. probably was not as much as a person who finds it easy to talk about things mm-hmm. would do.
But he wasn't in the midst of conflict or, well...
No, I don't think so.
Decision-making and...
Well, he was chairman of the department and head of research group and various things at various mm-hmm. times, and... naturally, there nothing goes perfectly and easily and smoothly all the time. And I did hear some of it, but I think that it was not to the degree that some families discussed department politics.
Mm-hmm.
During the time that Muir was trying to get the accelerator built here. That we talked about that a lot because it was such a struggle and there were so many things that had to be done to make this site attractive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the president of the university and got involved. And as I say, there were so many things that were done and talked about and printed that was very consuming. I mean, it sort of took up one's whole life.
That was
a topic of conversation all the time.
Who was the president at that time of the university?
I'm sorry to say I can't remember. It was in the... I can't remember who was.
Who was president after the Freds? Fred?
Elvium? Was Elvium after
okay,
the Freds?
Okay. I think so.
Yeah. I think so.
And this has happened during his
administration? It may have been during Elvium's administration. Yes, I think it probably was during Elvium's administration. I'd forgotten that.
He wasn't president very long, was
no.
he?
No.
And then Weaver?
Weaver was the next one.
Next one.
Mm-hmm. I remember Mrs. Elvium was such a friendly, warm... enjoying person. She enjoyed everything so much. And I can remember one time she talked about, she told me that, oh, they were members of our church too, so we knew them a little bit better. But she talked about how much she enjoyed eating ice cream before she went to bed at night. And she was a little bit stout. And I thought to myself, boy, I'm never going to do anything like that. And one of the things I enjoy doing is having ice cream before I go to bed. And I'm a little stout myself. It's a dangerous thing to say, yeah. No, I'm never going to do it.
Right. Life lasts a long time.
Yes, yes.
When did you first became interested in politics and community work?
Probably when I was, as I was growing up. My mother and father were both very active in the community and in the church and Boy Scouts. My father was a Boy Scout leader, got a Silver Beaver Award, and he was on the Board of Education. He started a kindergarten in the school system. So that was just sort of a natural way of life, and I'd always thought I wanted to be a politician, but I didn't really know what it was. So that when I had an opportunity to get active in the League of Women Voters, that seemed like a good beginning.
That was when you first came here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I had actually, I guess, in college when I had done some. We put on a. I was a Republican then. I'm a Democrat now. We put on a mock Republican convention on campus, and I was majorly involved in putting that on. The other thing we did, Massachusetts was a state in which birth control was illegal. And I remember we joined a campaign, a door-to-door campaign to try and get the state law changed. I didn't know what I was doing. We were so naive. Oh, Anyway, we went door to door in the village of Wellesley on behalf of trying to undo that birth control. I mean, we knew what we were doing, but it just was such, it seems like such a peculiar thing for us to have been doing.
Especially in Wellesley.
Especially in Wellesley. I hadn't thought about that for a long time either. And I was active in that. I did some social work in Boston at one of the neighborhood houses and was part of the group on campus that was sort of church-related. And we made some attempts with that group to draw in foreign students and black students. There weren't very many black students then, two or three, I think, on campus. I can remember being very shocked that they weren't particularly interested in being part of our group and wondering why. I know a good deal more now. But anyway, the League of Women Voters did a study, the State League of Women Voters did a study on minority housing, discrimination in minority housing in Wisconsin, and I was on that committee, and that stirred my interest in how terrible it really was, the housing patterns, discriminatory housing patterns, particularly in the southeast in Milwaukee. And the NAACP in Madison then did a housing study. And that was in the late 50, it was 59 and 60. And then they were in the process of developing the urban triangle, the mm-hmm. triangle area urban development project they'd gotten money for. And Florence Mazinski did a study of where people who came from that area who had to move found housing. And it was clear that it was extremely difficult for black people to find housing and also difficult for other ethnic groups to find housing in Madison. And that report, plus the NAACP report, plus the work that the League of Women Voters was doing, all sort of came together the year I was in Europe. And so when I came back, I became chairman of the citizens group that worked on the Equal Opportunities Ordinance in Madison. And that was a tremendous campaign and just electrifying in all sorts of ways because so many different people were working and working hard, giving everything they had to that campaign. The interest was so high that people, different groups wanted to claim credit for different parts of that effort. And so quite wisely, a steering committee was formed. With representatives from each of the community groups that wanted to become part of it. And we did succeed in getting that ordinance passed. The city council vote on it was very close, and Henry Reynolds was mayor at that time, and he cast the tie-breaking vote for the ordinance. But that was an experience that one never forgets, that whole effort for a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
It was fascinating.
And you met a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. discovered what people had prejudices and what people got emotional about it. And
mm-hmm.
We had parceled out the chores and tasks that needed doing, like getting names on ads in the paper, going door to door and doing surveys and having literature printed and writing letters and contacting other groups that weren't yet involved and getting endorsements from groups. I remember one of the difficult things we did was to appear before the city council and try and persuade the city council. There was a person named, how long have you lived in Madison?
64.
So you probably heard of Babe Rohr. He was a...
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, he used to strike terror into everybody's hearts when we had to get up in front of the city council. He was so upset and so against that equal opportunities ordinance that he would roar and bellow and ask questions that just made you feel like 2 cents. And it was an experience. I've gotten to know him better since then and have enjoyed knowing him. But at that point in time, we were just scared to death of him. And I can remember the first time I had to talk before the city council. I was so scared I could hardly talk. My knees were knocking together. All the traditional caricature kinds of reactions one gets We did a good job in front of the city council, though, because we had everybody's testimony lined up so that we didn't repeat ourselves. There must have been 10 or 20 people that appeared and spoke, and each spoke on a different part of the arguments for an equal opportunities ordinance. But it was a very revealing experience going around and giving talks to service groups and clubs and so forth. Because when you'd finish talking, and then if there were people there who were had big trouble accepting black people who were racially prejudiced, they would get up and say just the most ridiculous things. You know, there's no discrimination in Madison. Why are you stirring up all this trouble? And there must be outside troublemakers coming in. all the things that. Excuses that, mm-hmm. that people make were present during that whole campaign.
Like, it's not a problem here.
It's not a problem here.
They don't know it.
It's outside agitators, outside troublemakers coming. Mm-hmm. I can remember a year or so ago, I had occasion to talk to the person who was the mayor of Milwaukee at that point, and we compared notes about the efforts to get housing ordinances, and he told me about the time that people were talking about outside troublemakers from Madison coming to Milwaukee. we had a big laugh over that.
So the outside agitators from Milwaukee came to Madison. Oh, that sounds like a little McCarthyism, doesn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, yeah. Still going on, I guess.
Anyway, Keith spent a summer in India sometime in the late 60s, and I didn't go along because of the children, and he found that to be very interesting. He spent at a university, and it was an exchange program. The American professors went over to teach teachers, to teach professors in India. And I haven't ever been to India, and I'm not sure I want to go very badly, except that it must be fascinating.
Mm-hmm. If you could not see all the poverty and starving people.
Mm-hmm. When we got that ordinance passed, they offered me a position on the commission, the Equal Opportunities Commission. I was so exhausted, I said, absolutely not, I can't do anything. And that did exhaust quite a few people who had worked very hard on it.
And you still had your children.
And I still had children at home.
So what was your next move?
Became a member of the board of directors of the NAACP. Well, that was afterwards. I finally did accept an appointment to the commission, and I became chairman of the commission. We had several interesting problems that developed during that time. One of them was referred to as the Bree Stevens incident. The black people from Central High School, Central High School was still open then, the black students had been coming home from a football game at Bree Stevens Field walking up Washington Avenue, and they got into a confrontation with the police. And I got called from the jail at 2 o'clock in the morning by one of the black students whom I'd been working with. And that turned into a very serious situation, and we did an investigation of the incident and issued a report with a great many recommendations about what the police department should do to improve its relationship with the minority community. But one of the parts of that was that the city council wasn't sure they trusted the Equal Opportunities Commission to do the investigation. And they sent Mayor Feske to tell the commission that city council wanted to do the investigation. Another one of life's memories. I can still see Otto Feske sitting at my left at that meeting, and he said, he was talking to the whole commission, and he said that the city council wanted to do the investigation. And I looked at him and I said, Otto, the Equal Opportunities Commission is going to do the investigation. And he said, all right. But that took a long time, and we had tremendous arguments about who said what to whom. We had subpoena powers, and we took statements from policemen in public meetings. And I discovered that policemen do lie. I always thought policemen were the saviors of mankind. It was a real eye-opener.
Yeah, I bet it was.
And then Mayor Dyke got elected, and my appointment was up, and he refused to reappoint me because I had not supported his candidacy for mayor. That's when I got involved in the NAACP.
Were you a Democrat at that point, or were you?
Yes. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I became a Democrat when I graduated, I think, probably from college.
I see.
My family is all Republican
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you were on the end, you were what was
on the
your
board name? Of directors of the NAACP
I see.
For 1 year, and then Jim Sykes, who was on the county board, persuaded me to run for the county board. That was in 1970.
And you did.
I did, and I won. one of the good things through all this, just to connect myself back to the university, was that Keith was very supportive and encouraged me to continue. Never had one word of complaint about mm-hmm. what I was doing or all the time it was taking.
A lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so did you ever have any feelings like about going back to work at all this, any of this, or going to work or going back to school, or this ever occurred?
No, I guess I was too busy to think about doing anything other than what mm-hmm. I was doing. I took odd courses here and there at METC courses, things that I wanted to do, like learning to sew mm-hmm. and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Took a sewing course, and I put the zipper in the skirt in backwards while I was sitting in class. No, I didn't. I wasn't particularly thinking about doing any more studying. The women's movement then became. Oh, the other thing that was going on during all that was the student demonstrations.
Oh, yes. I wanted to bring that up.
Student demonstrations right. against the war in Vietnam, and when it became clear that the police and the sheriff and the students were sort of having a guerrilla warfare all that time. Some of us began to get active in trying to observe what was going on because there were so many charges being made back and forth with that. And we formed a group that would walk around during the demonstrations with white armbands on, just to watch and hoping to keep a lot of bad things from happening. But one of the games during that time was to try and spot the FBI and the CIA people that were around all the time. It was pretty serious stuff, actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But George Vukelic had a radio program on WIBA then in which he talked a great deal against the war in Vietnam. And Keith was very supportive of that effort. I think Keith appeared on that radio program a couple times. I have to ask him. I can't remember exactly. But there was a good deal of rumor about whose names were in what file in Washington, the FBI files and so forth. That's pretty serious stuff. It still
right,
is.
Right.
You still have to keep watching
mm-hmm.
so that it doesn't get out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the times I remember was Ollie Ashman was a councilwoman then, and we decided we'd go down together one night to with the white armbands on. And we were on Mifflin Street, and police had turned the street lights off, and they were, it must have been one of the first block party requests. It all runs together.
One that was refused.
Uh-huh. Anyway, the police were riding up and down that awful gray van that they had, pounding on the inside with their nightsticks to, I suppose, add an element of terror to the whole scene. It was just bizarre. drove up and down the block, the students lining the streets shouting. And the police stopped right in the middle of the block, and there must have been 10 or 12 of them poured out of this van with their nightsticks raised, throwing tear gas. And the students weren't doing a thing. They were standing along the sidewalk shouting. It really was guerrilla
mm-hmm.
warfare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because they were throwing gas, Ollie and I had to run. It was very undignified.
Oh.
I don't know whether we did any good or not. Who knows?
Yeah.
But that plus the work that we had done on the Bree Stevens report in relation to the police department, I think opened that up a tremendous amount. One of the consequences of the report, that Bree Stevens report, was that the police department, we recommended that they begin to get some training in human relations kinds of situations, and particularly in minority groups. And there's a center on, I don't know whether that's still there or not, an extension leadership training center.
I remember.
We use them a lot to work with the police department in workshops and training sessions. And one of the people that was part of that leadership training center on campus was a young black man from down south somewhere. And I sat in on one of the training sessions he was giving to the police department. Astonishing man. He was extremely convincing, and the parallels that he drew as he was trying to get them involved in understanding how black people feel were just real eye-openers. One of the ones that he did, I remember, that one of the popular phrases then was, why can't they pull themselves up by their own bootstraps? And he got one of the policemen to sit on a chair up against a wall, and he climbed on the policeman's shoulders, and he said, now, get up if you can. It was very dramatic. And that another thing he did, he took a necktie off one of the policemen and took it up to the front of the room, and he said, now, come and get it. These are my rights. It was a real education. At any rate, the Bree Stevens incident and all the complaints against the police department during the demonstrations, I think went a long way to turning that whole thing around. And I'm sure that if I were a black person now, I wouldn't say that the police department was perfect, but it's certainly a lot better
mm-hmm.
than it was.
Mm-hmm. That was really bad.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah.
One of the other times that it was bad was during a welfare rights march from, you may remember that, they marched from Milwaukee to the state capitol
mm-hmm.
and went into the capitol and then were locked in or chose to stay in.
Mm-hmm.
And a group of church women fixed food in the old Methodist church and took it into them, or they, I guess they were pulling it up in baskets up the capitol windows. How dramatic. Anyway, Father Dismas Becker was outside, and he would go back and forth from the Capitol to the Methodist Church. And he came in one night to the Methodist Church, and the blood was streaming down his face, and they'd been holding a prayer vigil outside the Capitol, and the police had come in with their clubs swinging. It was just horrifying to have that kind of thing going on in Madison. It just seemed impossible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that was bad enough so that it was, that also helped turn things around, I think. Dismas Becker is now a member of the Assembly.
Oh.
I see him every once in a while.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Oh, the other person that was involved then was Father Grappi from Milwaukee,
oh,
remember?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And our church...
Was he involved with the welfare?
March.
Oh, that's right, he was. Mm-hmm. And then he got involved with the...
desegregation in Milwaukee.
Yeah, yeah.
He, our church had, around that time, had started a home for boys, for lack of a better way of describing it, pre-delinquent boys, boys who couldn't stay at home for one reason or another. And we had house parents, and Keith was chairman of that committee. And they needed to find that the turnover was quite high.
Oh, I think we better stop.
Okay.
All right.
Keith was chairman of the church committee that oversaw the home activities, and the turnover on house parents was rather high, understandably so. And by that time, Father Grappi had gotten married, and he and his wife applied for a job of house parents there, and the committee decided unanimously that they'd be a wonderful pair to have as house parents in that house. And the more conservative members of the church, and in particular one or two who were very outspoken and very conservative, managed to sabotage that, and so the church council refused to accept the Grappis as house parents. That was a very sad experience also, because they would have been very good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that was all part of that whole sort of opening up of things, and all those experiences, I think, tended to reveal to people in Madison just how much discrimination and sort of right-wing ill will there was around.
Mm-hmm. That was never, never shown before.
Yeah.
As soon as anyone tried to
change things. Give everybody their opportunities, mm-hmm, and rights, then it reared its ugly head.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the other things that happened was a young man who took refuge in our church, sanctuary in our church, from the draft.
Oh,
do you remember
reading
about that?
Yes, yes.
That was also very dramatic. The church decided that they would grant him sanctuary in the church, and about 40 of his fellow students or fellow activists came in with him and stayed in the church. And the FBI had people stationed all around the church. We agreed that we had to have people, adults or church members, there all the time. So we took turns. We did shifts during that whole week he was there, staying there with him. And
so
a lot of
people
sent
in. You were.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people sent in food and,
mm-hmm,
kept it going. But some people were so bitter. A lot of the people that stayed with him slept on the chapel seats, which had pillows on them. And so some of the people were so bitter about it that they said they would never sit on those sullied seats again. It was very sad. Anyway, it also had its good effect, since,
mm-hmm,
it brought a lot of like-minded people together and
mm-hmm,
gave a very strong sense of community to the,
mm-hmm,
whole effort. One that still persists, I think. And of course, Paul Soglin got elected out of that whole move.
It was amazing.
One of the more colorful persons that we've had.
Yes.
And clearly he got reelected, and people recognized that he was doing a reasonable, mm-hmm, job as mayor.
That's amazing to think that he did,
yeah,
get elected,
yeah,
when you think about it. Did you see the movie on the Vietnam,
mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm,
war,
mm-hmm,
here in Madison?
It was interesting. Brought back a lot of memories, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So your husband was he was involved.
He was active in the church, and he was involved, yes.
In the by doing the radio and.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He also was moderator of the church for a year, their 1 year terms in the Congregational Church. And during that time, I can't remember what the occasion was, but one of the Chicago black persons, young man, wanted to speak at church. And they were, it's terrible not to remember names. He was very well known, gotten a lot of news coverage for his activities in Chicago. Who would that have been?
I don't know.
Huey Newton?
Well, it might have been.
At any rate, Kwame Salter was then just beginning his activities in Madison, and he was acting as a go-between between the church and the Chicago people that wanted to come and speak. And one of the troubles was that they were afraid of some sort of terrorist effort against them, and they wanted to put use metal detectors at the door before people came in. And you can imagine that that caused a great deal of consternation in the church. The church finally refused to allow him to speak, but Keith was the person that was talking to Kwame Salter at that point about the whole thing.
Now wait, was he involved with the Sterling Hall?
Kwame,
incident? No, your husband.
Well, no, he wasn't involved.
Did he?
Heinz Barshall. No, Heinz Barshall's research was the research that was destroyed by that bombing. Keith was, you know, there, part of the physics department, but otherwise, no.
Wow.
That was the Heinz Barshall's view of what was going on at that time was very interesting also. He had grown up in Nazi Germany and had observed that that anarchy was part of what led to the takeover by a dictatorial force and a dictatorial group. And he was very afraid that the demonstrations and the way some of the students were behaving, throwing rocks and so forth, was the beginning of that kind of cycle happening in this country. Mm-hmm. And he was very worried during those days. And of course, having his research destroyed by that bombing reinforced that terribly.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. I don't know that anybody ever linked the two up.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It must have been frightening to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was very hard.
I stayed away from campus. That's interesting that people were afraid to come down.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
To their campus.
Well, of course, there were very many different views and ideas and ways of looking at what was going on. I think if the people that saw it merely as violence erupting, probably were extremely worried, and Heinz, having had that experience before, was one of those. But it made a big difference how you thought about what was going on. I think how you felt about it.
Mm-hmm. So I had a baby in the middle of that, 1968.
Oh. Then in the early 70s, the women's movement began to get strong, and particularly in Madison. I went with Betty Smith and Kay Clarenbach and Midge to Washington when the Women's Political Caucus was formed. Mm-hmm. They called people from all over the country. And so that was another eye-opener. The poor women, economically poor, socioeconomically mm-hmm. poor, black women and white women, union women, feminist leaders, all the well-known ones, and we were there for 2 or 3 days deciding what to do and formed the Women's Political Caucus. But the descriptions of the ways that women had been discriminated against that were talked about there just were another depth of understanding about discrimination, sort of another eye-opening experience.
In what way?
Well, the descriptions that came from some of the women from around the country and job description and job discrimination and sort of the results of cruelty from husbands and relatives and just things that I had never thought about before. That was all. And the statistics that began to be developed about how unequal the pay was for women and the jobs categories and so forth. So we came back and formed the caucus here in Wisconsin, and which has been going strong ever since. It's been wonderful. And of course it's now greatly strengthened by all sorts of women's groups that have come together to work on that problem.
How has it affected you personally, besides being active in the Women's Political Caucus. I mean, in terms of your daily life.
I don't know that it's made a tremendous amount of difference. I presume that it probably made a difference in the ease with which my political activity was accepted during the 70s, because I became chairman of the county board for two or three terms and president of the Wisconsin State County Boards Association. And whether all of that would have happened if it hadn't been for the women's movement, who knows? I just don't know that. Good question. I'll ponder it. Because women, when I finally finished with the county board, I was on it six terms and didn't run again because I decided it was time to let some of the new young people that were coming up getting more interested in it. What happened was that the things that we tried to do and the changes that we tried to make, which didn't work in county government, the new young people coming on thought that they still needed to be done and wanted to try. And it isn't fair to sit around and say, I'm sorry we tried that and it didn't work, because mm-hmm. so it was time to get off.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time, the state of Wisconsin had more women elected to county government than any other state in the country. So that, I think that was a direct result of the caucus and the activities of the caucus, political mm-hmm. caucus. It was interesting to discover that some women are very afraid of being organized. I mean, they're willing to participate and get elected to office, but they're afraid of being seen as part of the women's movement and the feminist movement, and therefore they wanted nothing to do with getting organized. And I think that still is a problem among the state women. It's about 50-50. I was on the National Association of Counties Board of Directors for four or five terms. And we started a women's group within the National Association of Counties. And we suggested the possibility of doing it when we came back here to the county, women elected to county government. And the vote was maybe 1 or 2 percentage points against organizing a women's group in the state association.
Among the women, but voting.
Mm-hmm. A lot of women were, for various reasons. A lot of it personal reasons. You know, I made it without it, and I don't want them to think that I'm part of it and that I need it. And if I become part of it, I'm going to be ostracized by my county board, male county board counterparts.
Some real fears.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were never you never got organized.
I don't think they still have a mm-hmm. women's group. I don't know. I haven't followed it very closely.
What are you doing now?
Oh, I'm chairing Bob Castemeyer's re-election campaign.
Oh.
It's gradually warming up and taking more and more time.
Yes.
I haven't ever done a big campaign before. So this is a marvelous one because there are so many people that admire him so much mm-hmm. and want to work for his re-election.
Mm-hmm. So this is what you're primarily doing mm-hmm. now?
I spend about half time doing it now, and it'll be full time before I get through.
Mm-hmm.
We have a university doctor from the medical school running against us as a Republican. Have you noticed that? Al Wiley is his name. He's a radiotherapist.
Is he the man who ran last term?
Yes, he ran and was defeated in the Republican okay. primary last time.
He's from south of here, Oregon.
Stoughton.
Mm-hmm. Stoughton. Mm-hmm.
And the persons that are running his campaign ran Governor Dreyfus's campaign for governor. And Dr. Wiley is taking time, leave of absence from the university to run full time, so we're going to see a lot more of Dr. Wiley in the next few months.
Oh,
he's already had one car caravan around the district.
Oh.
I'm going to be exhausted again by the end of November.
How do you see your life in relation to the women's movement, the changes? Besides being very active in trying to organize. But do you see your attitudes about home, house, and family changing at all?
Well, I think in fairly benign ways, since my father had always encouraged us to make the most of our opportunities and to educate ourselves. In fact, he made us promise that we would, before we got married, that we would learn something that would allow us to earn our living if we ever had to. So he was, and he believed that we needed the best education. I'm talking about my sister and myself now. So that, and Keith was very encouraging all along, so I don't think it changed actual, it made an actual change in my life in terms of relationship to my family, but I think that I began to understand the significance of my life and what I was doing a lot better. I was able to see it objectively instead of just living it.
Mm-hmm.
To think about it.
What you've done in your life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing to do.
Yeah, it is. It is a very rewarding thing to do, to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Was your husband affected at all by the women's movement and the changes? Did anything happen at the university or in the physics department?
Oh, he became much more aware of the lack of women and the university staff and among the professors, I think. And he was also, of course, they were aware that they were encouraged, urged to hire minorities and women and put them in positions, staff positions, responsible positions. There are several women now in the physics department, and I remember one of the research grants that Keith got, federal research grant. I can't remember whether it was an absolute requirement or whether in order for them to get the money or whether it was just a very strong recommendation that they hire a minority physicist. And we got to know a person from Los Alamos who came to do the research here, lived here for a year, and we see him once or twice a year now. Very wonderful person. Enjoy him. But it did make a difference in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the women who have become staff persons in the physics department, he's I think Keith is much more aware of the ways in which those women might be treated better, or be treated, or whether they were being treated unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
He discussed that quite a bit.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, I think we can stop here. I think we've just about finished.
Good.